From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There are many postmortems of Donald Trump's presidency, arguably the worst 4 years in modern American history. Among them is a new book by writer Brendan O'Connor that distinctly makes the links between the resurgent white supremacist movement backing Trump and a fiscal conservatism fueled by billionaire elites. At the same time, a resurgent left rooted in movements outside the Democratic Party is also forming and taking a critical piece of the historical backdrop to Trump and Trumpism. My guest, Brendan O'Connor, is a journalist and writer in New York. He's written for The Baffler, The New Yorker, and The New York Times. He joins me to discuss his new book, Blood Red Lines, How Nativism Fuels the Right. Welcome to the program, Brendan.
Thank you for having me.
So first, as we are looking back on the Trump administration and these past 4 years, certainly there is this very stark and, as I said, resurgent white supremacist movement that is built on otherizing people of color and immigrants. But you specifically focus in your book on immigration as a sort of linchpin of Trump's presidency. Why is that?
Focus on immigration as the lens that I approach my reporting, partly because I think that the undercurrent of nativism and the building of nationhood around a specific white racial identity has been critical to Donald Trump's presidency, his campaigns for presidency, but also to the movement around him and the political forces that gathered to Trumpism.
So the very explicit words that Trump used when he was running for president, and of course the advisors that he brought on, people like Stephen Miller, started to take very strong action very soon in his presidency. And we now know that he instituted hundreds and hundreds of policies via executive action, but also using discretionary means in agencies to an extent that the Biden administration is still uncovering. But a very large part of it was focused on the border. And you traveled to the border, you've reported on Central American migrants at the border and what they've been going through. Give me a sense of why that aspect of US policy, which is still not really covered enough in the media, is central to understanding Trumpism.
I think it's critical to remember that while it's true that Trump, you know, issued a slew of executive orders, that they were prepared to do so right from the beginning of the administration, Trump was operating within the immigration enforcement mechanism and machinery that has been built and developed over the course of decades by both Democratic and Republican administrations. But this is a particular sphere that the executive has wide powers and wide discretion to be able to enforce the laws as it sees fit. And this has been so for over a century. The Trump administration and the Trump project quite clearly hinged, though, on the very public public repression of non-white immigrants and the exaggeration of the, you know, or the creation of the threat that they pose to white identity. And his whole political project hinged on being able to keep people agitated over this idea that white identity is under threat. This is not just a racial project, though. This has kind of economic and labor management aspects to it. But I would say that the repression of migrants, of migrant organizing, the deportation of migrants was a key part of the Trump administration's ongoing political project. And I think we will see it continue to be so in a Republican Party that is more or less embraced ethno-nationalism. I don't think that there's any future for the Republican Party where this isn't an explicit part of their political project.
How is it that those same conservative forces in the United States that participate in the anti-immigrant bashing benefit from very explicitly vulnerable immigrant labor? I mean, even Trump himself, and you point out in your book, seems to not be bothered by the contradiction that he went after undocumented immigrants while employing undocumented immigrants in his businesses.
Right. That's an important contradiction that I try to explore in the book. And one of the ways that I think that we can think about this is that the repression of migrant labor, whether documented or undocumented, is a key part of making that migrant labor exploitable. By putting migrant workers in a position of deportability, or making it so that they have family members who are under threat of deportation, you create a layer of the working class that is highly pliable. These are folks who are living in constant fear that anything they might do to annoy a boss, any kind of union organizing effort that might take place, will bring down ICE on their heads. And so in key industries like agriculture and construction and the service industry, you have huge swaths of the labor force that are in this extremely vulnerable position. And having a balance between, in order to create that, you need to mobilize nativist and racist sentiment. That is a ongoing historical process that Trump benefited from.
How much responsibility for this Trump phenomenon based on anti-immigrant rhetoric can be laid at the feet of Democrats who over the years couldn't decide what their moral position on immigration was? We've seen so many Democratic leaders pay lip service to being, you know, this is a country of immigrants, while then emphasizing immigration enforcement at the border, trying to do deals with Republicans for funding punitive measures at the border in exchange for pathways to citizenship. And that sort of muddled message, has that been part of the problem?
Absolutely. I think that if you look back at the history, we see that the militarization of the border and the expansion of the enforcement apparatus within the US borders was really driven by the Clinton administration as part of the expansion of the military industrial complex, and as part of the expansion of carceral politics that replaced the kind of legacy of the New Deal and the legacy of these universal social programs. So this is a dynamic that Democrats are caught in. They are caught in this contradiction. And ultimately, I think, again, it is important to remember that it's not just a moral question. This is a, you know, if when it comes to the morality, it is clear, but part of the reason why Democrats can't seem to come to a coherent and unified position on this is because they are also beholden to the interests of industry that rely on a hyper-exploitable, hyper-vulnerable labor force.
So where does the maintenance of capitalism come into all of this? We've often sort of seen discussions around and condemnations of white supremacy divorced from the economic system that we live in. There are, Republicans who say they're fiscally conservative, but who distance themselves from Trump, say they're socially liberal, etc. But where is that confluence around in the era of Trump?
The confluence, well, I think that we see it where many establishment and leading Democrats, their objection to, for example, Trump's border wall was not on the grounds that, you know, everyone ought to be able to avail themselves of freedom of movement across borders, but rather that it was an ineffective way of keeping people out, that instead we ought to be building a quote unquote smart wall. And rather than, you know, a big concrete barrier, we should avail ourselves of the latest and greatest drone technology and surveillance technology and artificial intelligence in order to monitor and enforce the border. Now, this is something that you will hear from Democratic politicians who I think sincerely believe themselves to be committed to racial justice issues. But both Democrats and Republicans are united in maintaining a global economic order that requires the hyper-regulation of the flow of labor across borders. And part of the, you know, the function of the border is not just keeping people out, but keeping even more exploitable labor in the global South and making sure that there are pools of labor around the world that global corporations can use to build, to make things at, you know, very cheap prices. So the border is, you know, the border goes both ways. This has a racial dynamic, and the racial dynamics are mobilized in order to kind of obscure what is actually happening, I think. But that's not to say that the racial dynamics are secondary, or that white supremacy is a kind of subsidiary issue. It's absolutely not. It's core. It's necessary to maintaining disorder from the jump.
And then, of course, the most useful aspect of attacking immigrants, especially from the perspective of elites that benefit from the vulnerability of these groups, is that it keeps the non-immigrant Americans distracted from their own plight, from their own inequality, from their own falling wages, lack of health care, et cetera, right?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I think that the spectacle of border enforcement and the spectacle of violence is a tool to keep, as you say, keep people distracted from the ongoing and expanding crisis of the, you know, the economic crisis, the health crisis, the crisis of the, of democracy, to sort of sublimate correct anxieties about what is going to happen into a kind of to channel those fears into the project of maintaining white domination.
Then we also have to look at the flip side of the fact that there is this resurgent white supremacist movement and Trumpism at the same time that there is this resurgent left movement. We saw, of course, in the summer of 2020, an incredible wave of multiracial protests demanding that Black people be treated fairly, that police stop killing them, but also rooted in the idea that we need to, you know, improve racial equity, that it's not just about police brutality, but a broader systemic racism. And many, especially sort of white liberals joining that movement, might have seen or might have cut their teeth during the Occupy Wall Street movement, sort of now joining in with these new protests. How important an aspect of the Trump era was the resurgent and is the resurgent left?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we kind of take several steps back and try and look at this from, you know, a very broad historical perspective, I think that what we might find is that since the economic crash of 2007-2008, we've entered a period of a kind of hegemonic crisis of of neoliberalism. And this has expressed itself in many different ways, from Occupy Wall Street to the movement for Black Lives that starting in 2015 and then ongoing this summer and around the world, with movements against neoliberal austerity from Chile to Greece. And I think that Trump's rise is a part of that story, and as is the rise of a newly organized renewed organized left in the United States. I think that the organized left has a longer and more difficult road ahead of it, towards building power and, you know, building a different kind of world than the, you know, white supremacist right does. I think that there are more doors open for organized white supremacy than there are for the socialist left in the United States. But that is not to say that, you know, this is an impossible task, far from it.
Right. I mean, if you read the right-wing media or hear or consume the right-wing media, the left is fully funded by George Soros and all of these liberal foundations that are apparently paying all our salaries to speak out and hold protest signs. I don't know about you, but I certainly am not getting any money from the Soros Foundation or any of these big foundations that do have a lot of money to spare. But what about those right-wing movements? We've seen, for example, in the summer of 2020 again, when you saw the right-wing Trump-backing movements speaking out against the shelter-in-place rules to protect from the pandemic, it turned out a lot of those gatherings that were held at state capitals of, you know, gun-toting individuals, anti-maskers, were actually organized by some of these very large dark money right-wing groups. So let's, and this is something that the right has a history of. We've had the Koch brothers and all of these networks of moneyed interests that have for years fueled things like opposition to the Affordable Care Act or for obviously Medicare for All. What are those links between those large billionaires and moneyed right-wing forces and the Trump-backed white supremacist movements, the kind of people that we saw at the Capitol on January 6th?
Yeah, I think that what we are seeing is that there is actually a kind of fraying or fracturing of these dark money networks, where there's so much money going around that there are parts of the networks that are actually kind of in a sort of rivalry with each other, that have different ideas about how to respond to these ongoing crises. More central parts of the Koch network were not interested in having, they were interested in distancing themselves from the anti-mask movement and the anti-shutdown movement, partly because they had access to power and didn't need to create this sort of reprise the Tea Party moment in order to get what they wanted. But there are other parts of these networks and other organizations that have their own agendas and have their own ideas about what they want to see. And there's money to be had. There's money to throw around. You saw, as you said, these organizations were involved in setting up the anti-lockdown rallies in the spring. Many of these same organizations were involved in the logistics of Trump's speech on the morning of January 6th, getting people there, and then which then resulted in the deadly riot at the Capitol. So there are linkages, but it is a complicated story because the right is not a monolith, just in the same way that the left is not a monolith. There are factions, there are rivalries, and it's important to understand that they don't all want the same thing in quite the same way.
Today, we are seeing a visible splitting of the Republican Party. Well, there's the Republicans who are appalled at Trump, who are simply leaving the party. They're not even remaining Republicans. And so that group that actually calls itself Republicans is shrinking so much. And then you have the obviously and overtly pro-Trump Republicans. Are you seeing that similar split and division in the universe of billionaire conservatives that fund these movements?
I think that remains to be seen. You're absolutely right that there is a fracturing happening, and whether it's at the level of, you know, regular rank and file voters or people in Congress and in government, there is a shift or a realignment that appears to be happening. How that plays out hinges in large part, I think, on how much explicit white supremacy, how much conspiracy theorizing, how much nativism the different industry groups that have historically backed the Republican Party can stomach. I think we will see that industry, like the defense industry, weapons manufacturing, parts of the tech industry that are deeply tied to the militarization of the border, the expansion of the military-industrial complex, will probably find themselves able to stomach quite a bit of white supremacy and nativism when it comes to the Republican Party. I think other industries, other trade associations, lobbying groups, you know, donor networks that may not be able to stomach it and may find their way to the Democratic Party, where that will have a whole other set of consequences, where they may bring other kinds of socially conservative ideas, and that may change the way that the Democratic Party operates, or it may just reinforce and retrench the Democratic Party against this sort of left-wing insurgency that is developing.
So then let's conclude with a conversation around the Democratic Party and where it ought to go if it actually wants to benefit from the, you know, the infighting in the Republican Party and actually understand that one can take political power when one's opposition goes down the path of white supremacy, a position that certainly will not be vindicated by history. What the Democratic Party could, of course, do is take a morally courageous position on issues like immigration. Now, on the surface, they seem to be doing so. You see the Biden administration having signed this flurry of immigration executive orders. But when you examine the details of them, and I'm not sure if you have, and certainly it feels like not enough in the media have, on a practical level, not that much has changed yet. I know it's only mid-February when you and I are first talking, but for example, even the ending of the Muslim ban, for those people who were affected by the Muslim ban, they're still not actually able to come into the country because there are other bans that are still in place that Biden has left. Those people impacted by the Remain in Mexico policies, again, not as though they're suddenly being allowed into the United States. At a practical level, the disconnect between policy and actuality is still quite stark. And again, the Democrats risk alienating people who they convince that they're on their side.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think while important steps have been taken to mitigate some of the damage and start to begin to correct some of the damage that the Trump administration affected on people, it's not happening quickly enough, and it's not happening expansively enough. And I think that there is a lot more work to be done, both on immigration directly, and then also there are things that the Biden administration could do that would empower the institutions and organizations, like civic institutions and organizations, that will be necessary to defend against a future Trump-style presidency. And talking about the revitalization of the labor movement, the revitalization of social programs that are necessary to fend against, the prospect of a Trump-like figure who is maybe actually even more effective. Part of the story of the Trump administration was that it was constantly tripping over its own feet, and just not able to achieve everything that it set out to. But that doesn't mean that someone like Trump couldn't do that in the future. And so we need to be able to anticipate that and build up the institutions and the structures to defend against that. And that's just not happening right now.
Well, Brendan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book. I know we just sort of started the conversation, and there's a lot more detail in your book that our audience can read if they check out the work. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Brendan O'Connor, journalist and writer in New York. He's written for The BAFTA, The New Yorker, and The New York Times. And we've been discussing his new book, Blood Red Lines, How Nativism Fuels the Right. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.